This episode of The Dig is brought to you by our listeners who support us at patreon.com/thedig and by Verso Books, which has loads of great left-wing titles, perfect for Dig listeners like you. One that you might like is Our History is the Future, Standing Rock versus the Dakota Access Pipeline, and the Long Tradition of Indigenous Resistance by Nick Estes. In 2016, a small protest encampment at the Standing Rock Reservation in North Dakota, initially established to block construction of the Dakota Access oil pipeline, grew to be the largest indigenous protest movement in the 21st century. Water protectors knew this battle for native sovereignty had already been fought many times before, and that, even after the encampment was gone, their anti-colonial struggle would continue. In Our History is the Future, Nick Estes traces traditions of indigenous resistance that led to the No-DAPL movement. Our History is the Future is at once a work of history, a manifesto, and an intergenerational story of resistance. I recently did a really incredible, in-depth, lengthy interview with Nick as well. You can find it at thedigradio.com. You should also really buy and read the book. Our History is the Future, Standing Rock versus the Dakota Access Pipeline, and the Long History of Indigenous Resistance by Nick Estes. Out now from Verso Books. Welcome to The Dig, a podcast from Jacobin Magazine. My name is Daniel Denver, and I'm broadcasting from Providence, Rhode Island. It's often said that history is written by the victors. Such accounts aren't just bad history, however, but terrible politics as well, because they normalize systems of domination in the present and protect their reproduction into the future. When people don't understand settler colonial history, for example, they come to see borders as natural and then demonize those who cross them. If, instead, we refuse to accept the conqueror's view as the normal one, the wisdom of the legendary Chicano chant becomes clear. We didn't cross the border crossed us. This episode of The Dig is an interview with historian Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, conducted by a special guest host, filmmaker Astra Taylor. Dunbar-Ortiz has had an unusual life as an activist and historian at the cutting edge of anti-war, women's liberation, and indigenous rights movements. She has written many books, including Roots of Resistance, Land Tenure in New Mexico, 1680 through 1980, and Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment. Her most recent book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States, has been adapted into an edition aimed at younger readers, An Indigenous People's History of the United States for Young People. Spanning more than four centuries, Dunbar-Ortiz documents how Native people have always resisted expansion of the U.S. empire and continue to do so today. But first, my short and sweet request for your support at patreon.com/thedig. I started this podcast nearly 3 years ago to provide the maximum number of people doing critical work to change the world everywhere unusually in-depth and complex left-wing analysis. And I hear from you by email and on social media every day. Labor organizers, Bernie Sanders campaign workers, fighters against mass incarceration, and am profoundly grateful that this show is useful to people fighting for a just society. That's our goal, and to meet it, we provide each and every episode free to all because those of you who can support us do so at patreon.com/thedig. What's more, if you donate $10 a month or more, we have left-wing books to send you as a token of our gratitude, including Samuel Stein's Capital City, Gentrification and the Real Estate State. That's patreon.com/thedig. If you're getting dressed for work or stuck in traffic listening to me right now, please remember to make a contribution when you're back at your computer. Also, I wanted to remind you that we have been transcribing a ton of interviews, and they're available now at thedigradio.com, our beautiful and relatively new website. Also at thedigradio.com, every audio episode is available there, organized by guest and by topic. Okay, here's Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, born in 1939 in rural Oklahoma, the daughter of a tenant farmer and part Native American mother, and a professor emeritus in ethnic studies at California State University. Astra Taylor is a filmmaker, writer, and political organizer. Her most recent documentary, What is Democracy?, is now streaming, and her latest book, Democracy May Not Exist, But We'll Miss It When It's Gone, is out now from Metropolitan Books.
Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, welcome to The Dig.
Thank you, Astra. It's good to talk to you.
So your book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States, came out in 2014. And a new edition, An Indigenous People's History of the United States for Young People, is just out from Beacon. And, you know, these are the kinds of books that one would assume would already exist. They just seem so evidently necessary. But, of course, they didn't until you wrote them. So I was wondering if you could begin by talking about why these books are important, how you came to write them, and, you know, also why you adapted the first edition for a younger audience.
It was something I thought from the very beginning when I finished the book that it was going to need a young people's edition, that I wrote it for a general audience, general kind of educated audience, but not... not academic, you know, not scholarly in the very formal sense, and certainly not using any jargon. Being a historian, trained as a historian, we don't use much jargon to begin with, but our work can be very dense, you know, with too many citations and too many references to other works. My editor was very good about culling that kind of thing out of the book. So actually, the book, you know, for 5 years it's been out, it has been used in a lot of middle schools, to my surprise, and successfully. So I took on the burden of raising a grant to do it. So actually hired an adapter, a professional young people's author and critic, Debbie Reese, who is Nambe Pueblo from New Mexico. And she agreed to do it. So it was a flat fee. So what's happened in the meantime is they worked on the book, and as Beacon got more excited about it, they decided to do young people's versions of the whole series of Revisioning American History. So the one on the queer history of the United States is also coming out in a young people's edition, and so will the others. So they've actually created a division because of it. But that's kind of a long story about the, you know, the nuts and bolts. I certainly kept track of the adaption as it went along, looked at everything along the way, but it really is... a skill in itself, you know, writing for young people or children that I don't have. And they've done just an amazing job of keeping the essence of the edge of the story, because it's a very harsh history of genocide and slavery. It's hard reading. You know, it's probably even harder than if it were kind of obscured with a lot of scholarly stuff. And it's just not, it doesn't spare anything. So they've kept that essence of the toughness of it and the hard edge of it, but also put it in language that's, you know, spare, and also have added, my original book didn't have any illustrations or maps or pictures. So it's just a really, and it's also much shorter. It's half the number of words as the original. It has, you know, it just came out last week, well, 2 weeks ago, and it has sold out, you know, several printings already. It's just really doing well. There's just so much excitement and interest, and part of that is the networks that Debbie Reese and her writing partner, Jean Mendoza, they've been doing this work for years. They're completely networked with all the middle school and elementary school teachers around the country and librarians who stock those kinds of books. So it's just been really a wonderful experience and outcome.
It's really interesting what you said about how it's in some ways a harsher story without some of the academic discourse, because I was surprised picking up the youth edition. It's still very hefty, even though it's half as long, and it's very direct, and it speaks to the young reader as though they're intelligent and can handle the truth. In both this version, but also the original version, are about truth-telling. And so I want to talk about the way the truth has been obscured. In both An Indigenous People's History, but also your book Loaded, you return to the ways in which stereotypes and narratives are promulgated to prop up settler colonial mythology, right? For example, you write that, quote, democracy, equality, and equal rights do not fit well with dominance of one race by another, much less with genocide, settler colonialism, and empire, end quote. So various myths had to be devised and apparatuses had to be invented to sustain those myths. You know, one example, you talk about firsting and lasting, the process of sort of writing Native people out of existence. So we see that in our world around sort of markers saying, oh, the first settler was here, the first school, the first library. And of course, that refers to colonizers. And so hear about, you know, the founding fathers as if they were the first Democrats. Meanwhile, there are stories of Indigenous people that emphasize endings. So you talk about The Last of the Mohicans by James Fenimore Cooper, who you point out was a land speculator, or The End of the Trail, the sculpture by James Earl Foster. You really dissect these myths. And I was wondering if you could talk about the origins of them and why they're so important, the way they're upheld by books and movies and television, you know, and why the settler colonial project can't exist without this propaganda.
Yeah, it's a whole, you know, mythology that is so deeply ingrained and so so all-encompassing, being, you know, just everywhere and so normalized that people don't notice it. It's some things that after I wrote the book, people would on Facebook, you know, social media, or even emailing me, give me additional examples in their local area of things like logos on, you know, when you enter a small town, there'll be, you know, the sign of the town, and then often they have a logo for the town. And in New England, apparently, I spent some time in New England, but it was before I was conscious, you know, looking for things like this. Logos that are racist, you know, they're just racist. They have, you know, little caricatures of Indians, and or one of them has a man in buckskin, you know, a pioneer, I guess, scalping an Indian, you know, or has him by the head of the, you know, head of the hair with a knife. And this is just normal. It's today, you know, it's there. And unless someone points it out and says, hey, we have to think about this, rethink this, which is going on, you know, now, but it's so vast, you know, when you think about it, it's just so deep and so vast that it sometimes it seems overwhelming. and that children, from the time they can walk and see, are just absorbing all of this as normality. So that's what, you know, I tried to, as much as I could in a book, is just make people aware, you know, and getting all those responses were very satisfying because it meant that, in fact, most people who wrote said, I had never thought about this before, but this is what I noticed today, you know. So consciousness is, raising consciousness is extremely important. Then people start learning on their own, you know, they don't have to be instructed on each and every thing, why it's not right. They see it themselves, and then they discuss it with others, and then they go to the town council or the, you know, their whatever their local government is, and they get it changed, and then they ask for demand an Indigenous Peoples Day, and, you know, this is then how the process goes, and it's a similar process with you know, with African American history and the, you know, the statuary, the Confederate statues, and that has not ended. It's still those, yeah. This and the first thing and lasting is that this is Jenny O'Brien, this amazing historian who has studied New England, and this is all over the country. We have this, the first town, and often the first town is settlers pushed Native people and set up their own, you know, white settlements. They often would name that first settlement Columbus. So you have Columbuses all over the country. And it's a big stretch because, you know, what does Columbus have to do with the United States history? You have to think it through. It's apparently a vital connection, and yet he never did touch the continental United States, what is now the United States. And it was two centuries later that anyone started colonizing in the, or before the British, the Anglos started colonizing. So that's a question I ask, like when I speak in one of those Columbus towns or they're nearby, is why is your town named Columbus? And Columbia is another version of it. And, you know, the District of Columbia, Columbia University. So that's another fetish, you know, that's just really interesting when you start thinking about it.
One thing that struck me in the beginning of your book is that these myths, they're not just upheld in the realm of fiction or, you know, placards in our community or the names of our towns, but they're also upheld in academic realms, right? So you mm-hmm. begin your book with a discussion of U.S. history and the standard periodization of historical events, which usually begins with the colonial era and then moves through the Revolutionary, Jacksonian era, the Civil War, etc. Can you talk about why it's not just enough to sort of insert Indigenous people into this pre-existing conventional historical narrative, as though you could just sort of add a dash of indigeneity to the melting pot of American history? Like, why do we have to rethink those categories?
In my book, I don't radically change that periodization. I make people aware of it, but I didn't want to make it too esoteric. What they did was, in U.S. history, they simply left Native people out altogether after the colonial era. And then at the turn of the 20th century, they invented a whole new field of history called Western history. Not Western civilization, but Western United States. And they segregated that, and that was the Indians. That was the conquest of the Indians. And it was always a degraded field, you know, considered a secondary field. And a lot of the elite universities didn't even teach it, didn't even have it courses in it. And so it's still not, you know, it's still not highly respected, although it has changed a lot with Native Americans kind of invading it and taking it over. It's become almost a Chicano indigenous people's history instead of Western history. But that periodization is generally excludes. So Indians are relegated to the colonial period, you know, the up to the revolution, and then really not dealt with that much in general U.S. history until, you know, the Army of the West, the post-Civil War period, and then only very, very briefly. And it's just astounding to me when I look at history textbooks and even university courses, their course outlines, how the war against Mexico, the invasion, occupation, and annexation of half of Mexico is sometimes not even mentioned, you know, and if it is, it's that they bought it. The United States bought half of Mexico, you know, like they bought the Louisiana Purchase. And that's what I grew up assuming, you know, they had been purchased for $15 million. And, well, you know, that's too bad, but that's not exactly what happened. It was a major war, and it was a war of counterinsurgency. It was the Indian Wars writ large, an invasion of Mexico City, which at that time was the largest city in the Western Hemisphere, and still is, and still was when the Europeans came, and occupied it, but that took a year and a half of coming in through the border, but also through Veracruz, and for Marines, really everything you read and know about Vietnam, the search and destroy, kill everything that moves, that was precursor, was Veracruz to Mexico City operation. They killed tens of thousands of Mexican farmers, you know, just peasants. And then they occupied Mexico City and put it under harsh, I mean, raping and looting and burning buildings and knocking down statuary, brutalizing and holding the government hostage, and forced them to sign a treaty of and so it's a, you know, it's an illegitimate treaty. It was signed under occupation. And that's why this border question, which is so pertinent right now, without this deeper history, it's not all that deep, you know, it's not all that far away. It makes no sense. It is a contested border. It is illegitimate. And even the proponents, you know, of a so-called immigration. So, you know, really, well, this, I'm talking about my next book. Sorry, this is, maybe I shouldn't get off on that. But, you know, I'm doing my next book that I'm writing now is on Nation of Immigrants. So it focuses on the border. But I have some of that, you know, in the indigenous peoples. And so the Mexican War is a part of that. But other thing is during the Civil War were some of the major operations against Native peoples, against the Apaches. The Navajos were rounded up during the Civil War by the Union Army and put in a concentration camp in southeast New Mexico, far from their homeland, and kept there for 3 years until the war was over. And the genocide against the Dakota people in Minnesota in 1863 and mass execution. So these, and Sand Creek, of course, the massacre of Sand Creek took place during the Civil War. So these were all, and both the Confederate Army and the Union Army were fighting Indians in the West, because the Confederates also wanted to, if they won, they were going to do the same thing. So There were two occasions that have been documented where Confederates and Union soldiers were fighting on the same side against the Apaches. And so that's, I mean, this leaving Indians out just, you know, it just flattens history and obscures it and twists it and makes it illegible of why we're in the situation we're in today.
I really am, you know, you got into something that I wanted to ask you later, but I'm happy to hear that that's your next book. It's an incredibly important topic. But maybe, do you want to take this moment to maybe say more about the issues at the border? Because one thing that's striking is how many of the people who are in prison there and separated from their families are Indigenous.
Well, and it is an Indigenous, you know, Indigenous peoples all across that border are cut in half, you know, half of the Haudenosaunee are in Arizona, are in Arizona, and half are in Chihuahua, and you know, all the way across the border, that's the case. And many, many Native people who took refuge in Mexico and enslaved Africans who freed themselves and took refuge in Mexico were, when the border was relocated with annexation, there they were back in the United States under United States control. And slaves were put back into slavery and Native people were killed. The ones who could make it went down to the new border and were given refuge again. But the Indigenous peoples of Mesoamerica, you know, Mesoamerica, and that includes Guatemala and El Salvador and Honduras, into central Mexico. It's a huge area of Mayan, Aztec, you know, many, many different peoples, all of them people of the corn. You know, this is where the corn, beans, and squash, the agricultural civilization was built upon and spread all the way to the subarctic and all the way to the Amazon and east and west as a unitary Western hemispheric agricultural culture and trade routes. So colonialism from the beginning, you know, Spanish and Portuguese started chopping that up, separating people. But that corridor from Mesoamerica to the Rocky Mountains, Utah, and to the Gulf, to the Pacific Ocean and to the Gulf, it remained unitary because the Spanish colonization, because they sought labor for the mines, they moved people around, lots of, you know, relocation of forcing people to work in the mines. Because the first century of Spanish colonization, the main slave labor force were Indians. They were, you know, actual slaves owned and inherited. But then, you know, there was the dispute in the church and state of the church wanted the Indians' labor. So that's when they introduced African slavery into on large scale. This integral, you know, these trade routes up and down that corridor from Mesoamerica to north of what's now Colorado and Utah, these were how peoples were formed, the migration patterns. For instance, the Hopi language is Nahuatl. That's the language of the Aztecs, because the Aztecs were from that area, and the Hopi are the people who didn't migrate to central Mexico. So their language is Nahuatl, and that was also the general language. So it's not just establishing the borders, it's also the U.S. interventions, because once Central America and Mexico became independent, Central America stayed a unitarian region, was the Republic of Central America. All of those Central American countries, including Nicaragua, were in that And it took only about 20 years for the U.S. and also the British to break that down, you know, to force them into these smaller units, multiple interventions, military and economic. And then Mexico was, you know, chopped off a huge part of Guatemala, which is now Yucatan and Chiapas and, you know, that whole Mayan area. So these creating all of those borders were problematic, but the northern border of Mexico, when it became independent, was the same as under the Spanish. So the 1850 creation of the new border was a major change in. But still, you see the trek of the, you know, the Central American refugees coming. You know, it's a traditional trek. When things would get bad in one place, people would migrate to the other, to other parts of that corridor. So in a way, it's traditional for these, for indigenous peoples in that area. But it's also, they also think, rightly, that the United States owes them something. You know, this should really be reparations because that they be able to come here. Because since the minute the Central American Republic was broken down, there have been, you know, that's where the term gunboat diplomacy was invented for interventions in Central America. They have just never left those people alone. And it's not even a place where there's a lot of wealth to extract from. They get all that they can, cutting down all the mahogany trees and, you know, whatever gold or silver exists. But it was simply decided by the United States that this was a strategic region they had to control. And, of course, they built the Panama Canal. And in doing that, you know, the country of Panama was a province of Colombia, the country of Colombia, and they just chopped it off and built the canal there, so it's its own country now. So the United States has just artificially recreated the whole of North America, because this is all North America. You don't get to the equator until Ecuador. So North America is this creation. So I just think that those of us who are doing protesting the border, that we really shouldn't call these people immigrants. You know, well, they don't call themselves that. They're calling themselves refugees, and that's really what they are. And they're not only that, they're refugees who, not from some other place in the world, there are refugees directly related to the United States creating the conditions that have made them refugees. So we need to have that consciousness that we're not just being benevolent or having pity or, you know, being humanitarian, but actually owe a huge debt.
One thing, you know, picking up from some of the threads, you know, you're talking about wars of counterinsurgencies and the outcomes of these wars and how the borders we have now are the product of these imperial campaigns. You also mentioned the Tohono O'odham Nation, and my family actually moved to Arizona right after I was born. And so we moved to a working class neighborhood. And in fact, it turned out that the groundwater was polluted by military industrial waste. There's a military base there. And so my sister was born with a physical disability. Tens of thousands of people died of cancer. And so this, I'm talking about 1980, the indigenous communities on the south side of Tucson, Arizona, are still dealing with the repercussions of this. And so, you know, in this way, we still have this incredible violence and this impact of militarization on a community. And of course, you know, the harm really can't be undone in that case. At the same time, in your book, you look at the way the military, so there is this sort of endless war, but then this kind of rhetoric also infuses the U.S. military. So if you look at the phrase Indian country, Can you talk about that and what that means and how it's not actually a literal physical place, but a kind of horrible metaphor?
It used to be a term that it's used in one way in Indian law as that's not negative for Native people, in that, for instance, some court decisions like the Bolt decision on water rights and fishing rights up in the state of Washington specified that although Native people had been reduced to smaller portions, that they had the right to fish in Indian country, you know, what had been Indian country. So that was a very positive thing, but it used that language. But in the Vietnam War, they started using the term Indian country to designate enemy territory. And it got shortened, you know, it gets shortened to in country. And I just wince every time I hear one of these network, you know, these cable TV reporters, especially Rachel Maddow, does it all the time, thinking they're being smart, using, you know, using technical language, saying, well, how long were you in country, you know? And it's like using this slur, you know, for enemy territory. So, you know, really indicating that it was an Indian War, and a lot was written, you know, at the time of the Vietnam War. The first thing I read written about it was by Tom Hayden, in a book that, you know, a small book that wasn't read very much, but he pointed it out because he had dealt with so many of these vets in, you know, he was an SDS and a student leader and then a peace, an anti-Vietnam War activist who was chosen to by North Vietnam to be the person who would come or select who would come to bring back U.S. POWs, that they wouldn't deal with, directly with the United States, but dealt with the peace movement. So he did that. So he knew hundreds and hundreds of these vets and listened to their language, you know, the way they talked to each other, their kind of codes, and they were using that term Indian country. Then, you know, others heard it, but it wasn't noticed, you know, all that much for some time until the Gulf War in 1991, when that was the next major open war after the Vietnam War, where tanks and 500,000 troops and all were used. They were using it again, and they were using it on, you know, these mostly Vietnam era officers coming on as consultants on TV and talking about Indian country when they'd be in Indian country. And so the National Congress of American Indians made a complaint, you know, and said that there were amazingly 23,000 Native Americans fighting over there and that it was kind of insulting. So they didn't really get it either, but there were other terms they were using. They were using language like when it's not time to plant the corn yet, it's not corn planting time yet. They were using colonial language. And what I figured out, and, you know, in my way, Indigenous People's History of the United States could be read as it could be renamed a Military History of the United States, because the U.S. military is completely formed, you know, by the Indian Wars. And this language comes down through not as code, but as lingo, how they talk to each other. So planting the corn, you know, had to do with attacking the Indians when the corn was before harvest to destroy the crops, because that was the method of warfare. Even though there's no corn in Vietnam, they were using this language because there's a kind of bloodline system in the military. Those who are permanently in the military, officers' corps and at West Point, of the language they use, and it's entirely built on the Indian Wars.
And you point out that this continues through to the War on Terror, right? Because the Navy SEAL operation to assassinate Osama bin Laden is called Geronimo, if I'm remembering correctly. And I thought one of the more chilling parts of the book, too, I had forgotten about this, was the way John Yoo, the University of California law professor who served in George W. Bush's Justice Department, right? He wrote that infamous torture memo from 2003.
Oh, John Yoo.
Right. I mean, he kind of defends the designation of unlawful combatant by going back to a court case from 1873 called Modoc Indian Prisoners. So this is very much alive today in the endless war on terror.
That was really interesting that John Yoo came up with that homo sacer, that these were unlawful combatants that had no humanity. They didn't have to be treated under regular law, and used a Supreme Court decision in the Modoc War cases of the 1870s here in California, Northern California. The Modocs fought hard to keep their territory in the North, and they killed a general, and that's what they were on trial for. At first, they were taken as it was a real war in the annals of the United States, the Modoc War. So legally, they should have been POWs, you know, that existed. You know, the Geneva Conventions already existed at that time, and the U.S. was party to them. And POWs are, you know, anyone is a non-combatant. Anyone who's not armed is not to be killed. And so they went ahead and, you know, the Supreme Court said that they could go ahead and hang them because they were undeserving of humanity. So he used that successfully as a precedent. It reintroduced it into current law. You know, that should scare people.
I saw something speaking, just how alive these issues are. I just came across an article this morning in the New Republic that's about indigenous land struggles in Brazil. And it quoted Bolsonaro, who's now the president. And in 1998, he said, "It's a shame that the Brazilian cavalry hasn't been as efficient as the Americans who exterminated the Indians." And then in 2017, 1 year before he became president, before he got elected, he said, "Where the native land is, there's wealth underneath it." Right, which is what it's all about. You make this clear that there's a battle over the land. And I wanted to just ask you to talk about that shifting perspective to really recognize that land is at the heart of all of this and at the heart of American history. I mean, people tell themselves the story of the American Revolution as, you know, throwing off the yoke of tyranny, but really it was about wanting to squat and steal indigenous territories, right?
Well, you know, settler colonialism is a specific kind of colonialism, and it's not the general one, which is horrible. You know, I mean, we understand more about Congo or the colonization of India or, you know, all the African, what are now African states. But the settler colonialism that the British introduced in the United States and then in Canada, New Zealand, and Australia was very much based on their own trajectory. The other European colonialisms were always, initially focused on South, you know, on Africa and Asia. But Britain was an island, and it was focused on conquering surrounding peoples and conquered the Irish. So in that conquest of the Irish, which I'm not sure it's ever really happened, you can't call it conquest, but colonization, they developed settler colonialism as a way of conquering in Northern Ireland to replace the indigenous Irish with settlers, Anglo and Scots settlers. They did that very effectively and made the Irish Catholics landless into tenant and sharecropping farmers, and eventually very vulnerable to famine. It's just making a monocrop of potatoes. So that was their, you know, their Cromwell's creation of even of wild Irish reservations. That's what he called them, wild Irish reservations. This was all before the colonization began in North America. So they brought that with them. I don't think they looked around and said, well, how shall we colonize? You know, let's look at the Spanish model. They took a lot of stuff, especially the racial caste system from that Spain had developed already in the peninsula before they went to the Americas in their expulsion of the Africans, the North Africa, the Muslims and the Jews. They had developed this cleanliness of blood, and they just added more categories when they got to the Americas of mulatto and quadroon and Zambo and Indio, you know. So they added these, but they adopted, they did adapt certain things, but they basically took their, went as a colonizing mission with settlers. And they also did it as corporations, not as the state. As in Europe, it was always the state that was, you know, the king, the monarch, that was ahead of any colonizing mission. But in theirs, they contracted it out to corporations, companies. So the Jamestown Company, you know, the and the Pilgrims, then they rounded up settlers to take. So this is the this is what led to the United States being founded as a corporation. You know, it's basically is a corporation, was founded as a corporation, not a traditional nation state in a way. If you read the Constitution, I mean, if you can bring yourself to read the arcane language, it's all about commerce, you know, all about corporations, all about finance. That's what it is. So this idea of freedom being wealth and being based on also these Puritan ideas of chosen, you know, being chosen, Calvinist ideas of being the chosen people. This is a really a strong brew that neither Canada nor New Zealand or Australia had, you know, the mixture of all of that. Plus the decision, well, 400 years ago this year, to import enslaved Africans. They had indentured servants, but definitely once they imported enslaved Africans, they were not. Some historians have tried to say that they were just indentured like everyone else, but no, the slave codes had not been developed yet, not for 50 or 60 more years, fully developed where the definition of slavery was African, but there already was the practice of the children of Africans, enslaved Africans, were enslaved. And that wasn't true of white indentured servants who Andrew Jackson's family were indentured servants. You know, they could easily, it was a way to get started, you know. So it's there's really almost no connection because slavery identified as African was created by the Vatican, by the Holy Roman Empire in 1454. With a papal bull identifying Africa as the fount of enslavement. So that was already long set before the British came. Those ingredients that make up what the United States is and the inherent genocide in settler colonialism of genocide being defined as an attempt to destroy in whole or in part a people as a people. It's a collective, you know, a collective thing, not how many individuals are killed. There, no individuals have to be killed as such. They usually are, but it's forcing them into situations where they can no longer have the integrity of being a people. That genocide over a period of 400 years is just something that's not dealt with at all.
I want to pick up on what you just said about ways in which the United States is exceptional. And you mentioned the Constitution. And so in An Indigenous People's History and Loaded, you talk about how we actually have a very strange relationship to the Constitution, like treating it as though it's this kind of sacred religious document. So I was wondering actually if you could talk about that, because you write, Great Britain has no written constitution. U.S. citizens did not inherit our cult-like adherence to the Constitution from the British. Right. So how does that set us apart? Why is it problematic or even pathological?
It's just so exceptional in the first place. I think most people in the United States think that there's no way there would be any kind of law without a constitution. But of course, 2/3 of U.S. law is not constitutional. It's based on property, common law and legislation. Constitutions are a kind of frameworks, and they get abandoned. France is on its 6th constitution, and a lot of countries don't have constitutions. Canada just got one, about 20 years ago. I think Australia has one now. I'm not sure about New Zealand, but they, and in Latin America, practically every regime, writes a new constitution. The one in Bolivia, was a very democratic one where they went all over the country, but it's still an organic thing. They're still developing, so that our constitution is the only one in the world that's just written in stone, and then you have this completely politicized 9 people who make decisions about it that are final. And it doesn't seem like a democracy in almost any terms that you can really stretch your imagination to what democracy is. And I know you've done that. It's just really odd in the first place, in that it's exceptional, and we're so unaware of it. We think that it's just the most wonderful thing, and the people who created it are practically given God status, secular God status, as even though they were slave owners and Indian killers, and that they somehow rose above all of that and created this perfect document. And that is an evangelical, U.S. evangelical trope. That's also, they're supporting Trump. They say it doesn't matter. You tell them how problematic the founding fathers were. They said, that doesn't matter. They were vehicles of God. They were vehicles. It doesn't matter. It can be all battered up, this vehicle. But they have special powers. It doesn't make them good people. But it doesn't matter. So how do you get around an argument like that? It's logical in its own sense if you accept certain premises, but it is, it is a covenant. It has that's the Calvinist contribution, is that was what Calvinism was all about. I grew up in a Calvinist religion, Southern Baptist, and it's a covenant that then gets translated, and the interlocutor for that transfer to the secular is John Locke, himself a Scotsman and a Calvinist, who created this idea of the social contract, of the contract. So again, it's a corporate, it's a corporation concept of the contract. It, has worked to make the U.S. the purest capitalist state. I think the United States was, I said, it was born as a corporation. It was born as a capitalist state, And it's eccentric in that way, too, or exceptional, because there were no capitalist states on Earth at the time. Capitalism existed, and it was being practiced. But there were no capitalist states. There were monarchies. All the European colonizers were monarchies until the French became independent and a republic, and they certainly didn't have a covenant idea of their constitution. If we become self-aware, I think one of the things I see some of my leftist friends and scholars doing is trying to show, there's book after book, especially in the last 20 or so years, of trying to show that the United States is not exceptional, that it's just like every other country, that it makes mistakes and it tries to be dominant. And then there's the whole anarchist wing of that says all states are the same, and they're all bad. But, that really begs the question of why is the United States so uniquely, differently bad? in terms of, for instance, having 800 bases around the world when the next highest number for any country is 5. Yeah, so I don't know. It's baffling to me sometimes how we normalize the United States as such and normalize the Constitution, but still hold it as sacred. So changing it is practically impossible.
This is Sarah Jaffe, and you are listening to The Dig with Daniel Denver, my favorite podcast for thoughtful discussions on the U.S. left and beyond. And you can support it on patreon.com.
This episode of The Dig is brought to you by our listeners who support us at patreon.com and by Verso Books, which has loads of great left-wing titles, perfect for Dig listeners like you. One that you might like is Edward Said, His Thought as a Novel, by Dominique Ede. In this personal portrait of Edward Said, written by a close friend, Dominique Ede offers a fascinating and fresh presentation of his work, from his earliest writings on Joseph Conrad to his most famous texts, Orientalism and Culture and Imperialism. Ede weaves together accounts of the genesis and content of Said's work, his intellectual development, and her own reflections and personal recollections of their friendship, which began in 1979 and lasted until Said's death in 2003. Throughout, she traces the connection between personal history and theoretical options, illuminating the evolution of Said's thought. Both specialists of Said's work and newcomers will find much to learn in this rich portrait of one of the 20th century's most important intellectuals. Edward Said, His Thought as a Novel, by Dominique Ede, out now from Verso Books.
One way that we're very exceptional, and it relates to this, is, and it relates to your book Loaded, right, is in the extreme rates of gun violence. And so, the Second Amendment is this, constitutional bullet point that allows the gun lobby to sort of wrap themselves up in sanctimony. And as you point out in both books, but at length and Loaded, is that it also obscures the true purpose and historical roots of the Second Amendment, which absolutely relate to indigenous history, right? And the settler drive to murder native people and steal their land.
Yeah, and for slave patrols. In the late 1600s, when they had ethnically cleansed the area of, Virginia, but it had then become, also South Carolina, North Carolina, slave owners from Barbados moved up and founded the colony of South Carolina, and they had developed slave patrols because they're completely repressive system there where they were the minority, white people were the minority, and there were constant and successful insurrections they developed these brutal slave patrols, and they brought them with them. And that concept, the colonies already had their militias to fight Indians, so they carved out of those Indian militias the slave patrols. These are really can be traced also to the modern police forces, you know, how they operate. The language of slave patrols becomes the language of modern policing. And in Loaded, I trace how that happens with the Confederacy, where the slave patrols operated, especially in the Cotton Kingdom. They became highly organized, and with the use of horse and dogs, because there was a constant insurrection in the swamplands of the Mississippi, swarming insurrections taking place, insurrections of actually marooning in the swamps with the working, you know, enslaved people providing resources to them. And there was just no way they could control this other than total brutality. And they still had massive insurrections, armed insurrections by slaves. So when the Confederacy was defeated, the slave patrols kept operating all, you know, as best they could all through the Civil War to try to control the slaves. And when the Civil War ended and slavery was abolished, they were made illegal. Slave patrols were made illegal by the North, you know, in the first era of Reconstruction. So within 3 months of the occupation of the Union occupation of the South, the Ku Klux Klan had formed, and these were just the slave patrols that put on hoods. And they were illegal for a few years until the army left and they took the hoods off, and then they were no longer slave patrols. They were sheriffs and policemen. And so there was no Klan. The Klan disappeared, but it didn't disappear. It just, you know, it just morphed back into legalized patrolling. So just the term that's still used, patrolling, you know, it comes from slave patrols, patrollers. So this is, you know, this is the problem we have, I think, with the police shootings of young black men, and they're running away, shooting them in the back. This is it's as if what's built into police training is no longer overtly racist, and even black and Chicano and Puerto Rican cops are trained, but they all do it. It has to come from the DNA of slave patrolling. That's serious stuff, you know, that the kinds of things that live in the unconscious that act out are deadly. But yeah, back to the guns, the proliferation of guns, and the Second Amendment is also considered sacred because it's part of the Constitution. And it is, and it was very intentionally put there for, you know, individual settlers to be able to organize themselves. And the only thing about the well-regulated militia is that is to distinguish it from highwaymen, you know, bandits, robbing people. Settler colonialism was all about self-regulation, people organizing themselves, because there's no way the U.S. state or the U.S. army could do all that, you know, all that local fighting to take Indian land. It was settlers' wars, and this was, you know, how it the whole continent was taken. So that kind of self-organizing, I think you see it in these white nationalist groups forming now, or have never really gone away, but definitely coming out more in the open now, is that they're actually very well organized in that self-organized way. And we all know we're good at that, you know. U.S. people are good at self-organizing. There are all kinds of community organizations and everything. And there are aspects of that that's very positive, but it also, you know, is it comes from that. That's why you have to see that as a context for what the Second Amendment means in terms of both. It looks like a contradiction, the right to bear, individual right to bear arms, and a well-regulated militia. You know, that to the modern liberal thinker, this is like, that means it has to be the National Guard, you know. And, well, if it was that, why did they put it that in the Constitution itself? You know, Article 8 is the founding of the National Guard. So you don't need it in, you know, in the Bill of Rights for individuals. So it means what, you know, it really does mean individual right to bear arms. So that is a, you know, a constitutional right of people now. And it's not, you know, you can't say it's outdated. You can say the whole Constitution's outdated, I guess, but it gets interpreted all the time. It's still being acted out. So unless you question the sacredness of the Constitution, you really have no argument against it.
I want to pick up on the theme of democracy that you mentioned, because obviously that's very dear to me after finishing my book.
Yes.
And it's, you know, it's a thorny question what democracy is. And you mentioned self-organizing. And that, as you said, there's positive aspects of that. But it can also have these troubling dimensions. And so I wanted you to sort of reflect on the word democracy, because it's a question that's brilliantly woven into your book. And as you point out, the two presidents sort of associated with small d democracy in America, Thomas Jefferson and Andrew Jackson, you know, were hostile to indigenous people. I mean, especially Jackson, right? And you write and say, it is not that Jackson had a dark side, as his apologists rationalize, in which all human beings have, but rather that Jackson was the dark knight in the formation of the United States as a colonialist, imperialist democracy, a dynamic formation that continues to constitute the core of U.S. patriotism, end quote. And you write that, you know, all presidents after him, consciously or not, refer back to him. And what you say is they refer back to him on what is acceptable and how to reconcile democracy and genocide and to characterize it as freedom for the people. I mean, and we definitely see that with Donald Trump, who I'm pretty sure he says that Jackson is his favorite president.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and given Trump, I was struck also by this section of your book. You write, when Jackson was inaugurated in 1829, he opened the White House to the public, the majority in attendance being humble poor whites. He was easily elected in 1832, although landless settlers had acquired very little land, and what little they seized on was soon lost to speculators, transformed into ever larger plantations worked by slave labor. You know, and you've thought about this so much. I want to know your thoughts. You know, yeah, where does this leave the ideal of democracy? What do you make of this word, the fact that it's associated with these figures who are, I mean, problematic? It doesn't capture it.
Well, you know, I think the way they were, of course, you know, Republicans say it's U.S. isn't a democracy. It's a republic.
Yes, I hear that all the time.
They're kind of splitting hairs because, well, you know, the source of it is problematic. The Demos is were the chosen ones, slaves and women, and it was a particular group of people. So its very sources that are so honored were themselves, you know, a template for a settler democracy. So there is a settler democracy, I think, in the United States. I think it exists. And I know at least one book, and I can't think of the name now, but a fairly recent book, is a really interesting argument. He makes all the same arguments I do. I doubt he read my book. In fact, I think it was published the same year my book was. But he makes all these arguments he says, but there does exist a settler democracy in the United States. But my argument is that what he's not dealing with is white supremacy. And that's not just the United States, you know. That has its source in Christianity itself, at least once Islam came about. But Christianity in itself, from the beginning, in the you know, in the hatred of Jews. Jews is a specific enemy. So Christianity was from its onset exclusive, although proselytizing religion. But then when it became the Holy Roman Empire and they created this, you know, in Spain was the crucible for this, but not the only place, but it is what established this idea. Actually, it's not just a doctrine, it was a law of the cleanliness of blood, of your humanity depended on your pure Spanish blood. And at the time, that wasn't color-coded necessarily, although those Moors were pretty dark. They were North Africans. But it wasn't specifically put in, you know, in color codes. But it's so infiltrated the, even, you know, England, this was like early 1500s, that the cleanliness of blood. So the British, when they're colonizing Ireland, they call them apes. You know, they're not human, they're apes. They're a different, so they, you know, they othered in their own, you know, democracy, you know, you could say was developing. They othered people who looked just like them. So that transfer to then making, well, what already had been done, you know, in the middle of the 15th century, of identifying Africa as the source of a permanently dehumanizing status of slavery. So it's that whole history just comes into the United States, you know, from all these different directions, and with all the settler democracy was also identified completely on in the Lockean sense of the individual, you know, the individual's productivity, but also the individual's capacity. So almost these centuries of the development of the United States, you've almost, you have these self-organizing things, but it's not really built into it necessarily that there's a sense of a collective. I think there are human aspirations to that you see in the socialist movements of the early 20th century, that people really seeking a sense of collectivity and anti-capitalist.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that, because the socialist ideal, too, is one of solidarity, right? I mean, that's sort of right. What this collectivity you mentioned, and this is, you know, a sort of thread in the book that I found very poignant is, you know, how solidarity is hard to cultivate. And you put this in a really pointed way when you're talking about the Civil War and the regiments of Black soldiers who ended up fighting Indians, right? And you write, quote, "After the war, many Black soldiers, like their poor white counterparts, remained in the army and were assigned to segregated regiments sent west to crush indigenous resistance. The reality strikes many as tragic, as if oppressed former slaves and indigenous peoples being subjected to genocidal warfare should be magically unified against their common enemy, the white man. In fact, this is precisely how colonialism in general and colonial warfare in particular works." And so you talk about, they were called, right, Buffalo Soldiers, which is a phrase you point out that people might recognize from the Bob Marley song. But it's just this point that solidarity isn't spontaneous. It has to be cultivated. And you give some examples. You mentioned the Green Corn Rebellion of 1917. But, you know, where do you see that solidarity emerging historically? And do you hope for a kind of socialism that can address some of these issues?
Well, I think it really has to be a decision. I'm thinking of, you know, I worked in solidarity from the time I was a graduate student in the 1960s to the end of apartheid and anti-apartheid. I met African students at UCLA who were in exile from South Africa, and they were associated with the African National Congress. So we formed an anti-apartheid group there. So I was always in touch with, and I learned so much from them. I learned, for one thing, about settler colonialism and how it works. They told of, you know, how they could never win guerrilla warfare. They had to win politically. And the main reason was because about 80% of the troops that the South Africans used, the South African apartheid regime, were indigenous Africans, black Africans, and in particular the Bushmen, who were trackers like no other people in the world. You know, that whole Southern Africa area, they had long been trackers, hunters. And I said, well, I was confused by that when I was young. I said, because they, there in London, where I spent 3 months with them, you know, with the ANC International, a lot of these were, well, they were mercenaries. Some of them were mercenaries, but they would come to London after they, so there were all these pubs that were either ANC or they were mercenary pubs. And the ANC had the project of going and changing the minds of these soldiers, you know, that they're fighting on the wrong side. And that kind of humanity just, you know, just really blew me away. And then after their victory, you know, after they took power, instead of punishing the Bushmen, who were, you know, very impoverished people, they certainly were not treated well by the South African apartheid government by any means. It kept taking their land, you know, their hunting grounds. And instead of punishing them, they restored a great deal of their land base, you know, and put investments into their communities and everything. So I don't know how we reach that kind of level of solidarity, you know, but I think it was deeply ingrained in the culture, but also just, you know, the leadership of people like Mandela. But I did see it, that it could be done, you know, that you could turn enemies into friends. And but that's the first I really understood the Indian Wars better, because it always bothered me that, you know, the main people that the U.S. Army was using to attack the Lakota, the Sioux, were the Crow Indians. At the Battle of Little Bighorn, half of the dead bodies of the 7th Cavalry were Crow Indians. And, you know, then historians try to make it as if Crows and the Lakota were traditional enemies. Well, they weren't, you know, but that's how to create enemies. Colonial forces know that, is that they can create intertribal warfare. And they did that throughout Africa, Asia, Latin America, and North America. So I think we have to understand that it's that people's minds can change, and that they, everyone is compromised by colonialism. You know, they dispute whether, well, there were Arab slave traders, there were Jewish slave traders. Well, you know, most of the ones who were on top were, of course, Europeans. Yes, even Rambo, you know, became a slave trader. So even the poets were slave traders. So it's, and there were Africans who were slave traders, you know, like Africans. So this kind of then, you know, measuring people's struggles by, well, why can't they, you know, why can't they all fight together? You know, why did the Vietnamese, you know? Well, there's, you know, there's colonialism, then there's class.
One difference between the original version of An Indigenous People's History and the new edition, An Indigenous People's History for Young People, is that the last few chapters are different, right? Because you account for the new movements, the rise of the water protectors. And so we're in this moment right now where people are talking about the environment and talking about a new deal and a green new deal. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, of course, the Democratic Socialist in Congress, was inspired by going to Standing Rock. And so I guess I want to kind of end here. Your books also talk about the legacy of the original New Deal on Indigenous populations. But, you know, as people are taking inspiration from that period and also looking to Indigenous communities for a kind of leadership moving forward, and new ways of other ways of relating to the land, to everything in the non-human world that sustains us. What lessons can we draw on? What thoughts do you want to leave us with?
Yeah, it's great that the new, the young people's version of the book, they were able to include the water protectors and the Standing Rock. You know, Standing Rock was an absolutely amazing event. And I think it's the first time that so many people were on Indian land, you know, in a Native community. Standing Rock is a very special place. Standing Rock was, just stands for resistance. This is where Sitting Bull is buried. This is where the Dakota people who fought in Minnesota, the genocide, where they were taken in as refugees. So it's not a pure place, just a pure lineage. It's a site of resistance. And most Indian, the lands that still belong to Native people, these are generations of people who fought for that land. So it's just, it really should be called sites of resistance, not Indian reservations. And so I think these seeds were planted, like AOC, who decided to run for Congress based on the courage that she realized she had. And so I think it's very hard to measure, you know, how this will continue. But I know one thing that's come out of it is an organization that is very important called the Red Nation. The Red Nation is a self-defined socialist, Marxist-oriented organization that started with Navajos and Pueblo and Apache people and a Lakota or two, one being Nick Estes, in Albuquerque, where the professor, Jennifer Dinadali, a Navajo professor at University of New Mexico, who was working with the homeless people in Albuquerque, 80% of the homeless in Albuquerque are Native people. And there were a couple of fires, you know, burning up their camps, and then one Navajo homeless person was killed. So she called on, you know, and put the word out and called on the students, undergraduates there and others to organize, and also in Gallup, where it's just, you know, a constant, it's a homeless and a skid row, you know, and brutalized Navajos all the time. So they really started with a community organization project. So that's their roots, and that's how they've developed. And in the past 4 years, it's just remarkable, you know. How the other thing is, there have been long time conflicts between Pueblos and Navajos over land, you know, and the Hopi Navajo dispute over land. And it's all really originally Pueblo land, it's true, you know, but colonialism piled people upon people. And so they haven't worked all that well together in the past. And this has really brought the young people together in ways that are influencing then their whole communities. And so, and then they work very closely with, they're very involved with assisting, you know, the refugees at the border, sending people down constantly. They have grown. I think it's just really the most important organizing effort. It's not a, there are no officers. They work by consensus. They have their, you know, different groups that just, you know, work. They just have certain commitments that they adhere to, and And people can go and take a look at rednation.org and join if they want to.
That's wonderful. Yeah, a new vision of democracy, right?
Yes, it's the most democratic organization I've seen in a long time. Yeah.
I think that's a wonderful place to end this. I really want to thank you for taking the time. And I want to just recommend to everyone listening that they check out all of your books. There are many, many books covering so many topics we didn't get to address here. So thank you again, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz.
Thank you, Astra.
Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz is a professor emeritus in ethnic studies at California State University and the author of many books, including An Indigenous People's History of the United States and An Indigenous People's History of the United States for Young People. Astra Taylor is a filmmaker, writer, and political organizer. Her most recent documentary, What is Democracy?, is now streaming. And her latest book, Democracy May Not Exist, But We'll Miss It When It's Gone, is out now from Metropolitan Books. Thank you for listening to The Dig from Jacobin Magazine. As Marx once said, after noting that the discovery of gold and silver in America, the extirpation, enslavement, and entombment in mines of the Aboriginal population, the beginning of the conquest and looting of the East Indies, the turning of Africa into a warren for the commercial hunting of black skins, signaled the rosy dawn of the era of capitalist production. While other podcasts have only interpreted the world in various ways, our point is to change it. We are posting new episodes every week. The Dig was produced by Alex Lewis, with editing this episode from Robert Waldorf. Music by Jeffrey Brodsky. Our communications coordinator is Julia Rock. Our senior advisor is Thea Riofrancos. Check out our vast archives at thedigradio.com and transcripts too. Follow us on Twitter at thedigradio. And please find us wherever it is you get podcasts and subscribe. Wherever that is, please leave us a nice review. Those reviews help introduce us to new listeners. What also does that is you telling friends, family, strangers on the internet about the show. Please make propaganda for us. And do find us at patreon.com/thedig and make a monthly contribution to help keep this operation up and running strong. Even a few bucks a month is huge.